recognition of Eastern Europe's borders in return for pledges to respect human rights in the Helsinki Accords of 1975. They issued a joint communique and a statement of basic principles. The first of those principles stated that both countries will proceed from the common determination that in the nuclear age there is no alternative to conducting their mutual relations on the basis of peaceful coexistence. Nixon addressed a joint session of Congress upon his return, saying, "Everywhere new hopes are rising for a world no longer shadowed by fear and want and war. To millions of Americans for the past quarter century, the Kremlin has stood for implacable hostility toward all we cherish. And to millions of Russians, the American flag has long been held up as a symbol of evil. No one would have believed even a short time ago that these two apparently irreconcilable symbols would be seen together as we saw them for those few days. 3/5 of all the people alive in the world today have spent their whole lifetimes under the shadow of a nuclear war. Last Friday in Moscow, we witnessed the beginning of the end of that era." Nikita Khrushchev, who had helped pave the way for this monumental change, was not around to see it. He had died of heart failure the previous September. Living in a log cabin, he had become a critic of the Soviet government and its heavy-handed suppression of dissent. He infuriated Soviet leaders by smuggling his memoirs out of the country. Published in the West under the title Khrushchev Remembers, it became a bestseller. In it, he mused sadly about the peaceful world he and Kennedy had wanted to achieve. The Soviet Central Committee decided to downplay his funeral, burying him in a corner of a Moscow cemetery. No monument was erected for 4 years. On June 17, 1971, the United States and Japan signed a treaty that allowed Okinawa to revert to Japan in May 1972. The Japanese had recoiled at the United States' use of Okinawa as a base for operations in Vietnam and a storage site for nuclear weapons. Okinawans concurred. According to the new treaty, the United States would sell Okinawa back to Japan, but would retain its bases on the island and use them for combat in the region. Japan not only paid the United States an exorbitant sum to buy back the island, it agreed to make large annual payments toward the costs of retaining the bases. Elsewhere, the United States paid host countries for the privilege of putting bases on their land, or at least shared the cost. To make matters worse, Prime Minister Eisaku Sato subverted the agreement by secretly allowing the United States to reintroduce nuclear weapons into Okinawa. The conflict over Okinawa went back more than a decade. In 1960, the United States and Japan had concluded the Treaty of Mutual Cooperation and Security, widely known by the Japanese abbreviation AMPO, which sanctioned continued U.S. occupation of Okinawa and retention of U.S. military bases elsewhere in Japan. Opposition had been so widespread and protests so massive that the government of Prime Minister Nobusuke Kishi, Sato's older brother, had been forced to resign. Kishi had also blundered by telling the Diet that the Japanese constitution did not ban the development of nuclear weapons, a view that was anathema to most Japanese. U.S. Ambassador Douglas MacArthur had complained that latent neutralism is fed on anti-militarist sentiments, pacifism, fuzzy-mindedness, nuclear neuroses, and Marxist bent of intellectuals and educators. The previous year, MacArthur had pressured the Chief Justice of the Japanese Supreme Court to overturn a Tokyo District Court ruling that U.S. forces in Japan represented war potential and therefore infringed upon the anti-militarist Article 9 of the Japanese Peace Constitution that General Douglas MacArthur, the ambassador's uncle, had helped fashion during the occupation. Article 9 states, "The Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation, and that land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained." During that time, the Japanese government had also concluded the first of a series of secret agreements with the United States, in which the government supported U.S. nuclear strategy and military preparations. The most egregious offense had come in the tacit agreement that no prior consultation is required for U.S. military vessels carrying nuclear weapons to enter Japanese ports or sail in Japanese territorial waters. But the smoldering tension between the United States and Japan flared under Nixon. Japan's consternation and surprise over the United States' opening to China only exacerbated the two countries' long-standing military and economic differences. U.S. leaders had continuously pressured Japan to revoke Article 9 and play a greater role in regional defense. The United States also threatened to impose import quotas against Japanese textiles, forcing Japan to cut its textile exports, allow in more U.S. imports, and open its market to U.S. investors. Nixon privately complained about the Jap betrayal and expressed his eagerness to stick it to Japan. Sato had been a willing partner in the United States' push for the remilitarization of Japan. Perhaps too willing. He had taken office in November 1964, just 1 month after the Chinese atomic bomb test. He had met with President Johnson in January 1965 and declared that if CHICOMs, Chinese communists, had nuclear weapons, the Japanese also should have them. He had added that Japanese public opinion will not permit this at present, but I believe that the public, especially the younger generation, can be educated. Such a view had widespread support among Japanese leaders in the ruling Liberal Democratic Party. Yasuhiro Nakasone, the director of the Japanese Defense Agency and a future prime minister, commissioned a report by the agency that concluded, "It would be possible in a legal sense to possess small-yield, tactical, purely defensive nuclear weapons without violating the Constitution." But the agency recommended against doing so at that point, a stance that Johnson welcomed. It was Sato who tried to hoodwink the Japanese people into believing the sincerity of his anti-nuclear statements when he articulated the three non-nuclear principles before the Diet in December 1967. According to those principles, Japan would not manufacture, possess, or permit the introduction of nuclear weapons into Japan, a commitment that Sato was regularly breaking, and that he described to U.S. Ambassador U. Alexis Johnson as nonsense. When Japan had signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1970, it had extracted a promise from the United States that it would not interfere with Tokyo's pursuit of independent reprocessing capabilities in its civilian nuclear power program. Given Japan's technological capability and stockpile of spent fuel, it would always remain one screwdriver twist away from having nuclear bombs. Not everyone applauded Nixon's rapprochement with China and the Soviet Union. The North Vietnamese feared that they were being hung out to dry. As a New York Times editorial noted, Chairman Mao received President Nixon shortly after heavy bombing of North Vietnam had resumed. Secretary General Brezhnev received the president shortly after North Vietnam's harbors were mined. No words are needed for Hanoi to understand that the Chinese and Soviet leaders put their own interests first. Though most Americans applauded his bold initiatives, Nixon braced for a revolt by former allies on the right, who thought he had betrayed them by visiting China, concluding arms control treaties that allowed the Soviet Union to gain nuclear parity, pulling most U.S. troops out of Vietnam, taking the United States off the gold standard, imposing wage and price controls, and embracing Keynesian economics. They were also upset that he had established the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, and the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, endorsed a guaranteed annual income for all families, supported the Equal Rights Amendment and Endangered Species Act, and strengthened the Voting Rights Act. Opponents of détente and arms control struck back, spurred by former RAND nuclear expert Albert Wohlstetter. Applying game theory and systems analysis to defense policy, Wohlstetter based his projections not on what the Soviets were likely to do, but on what they were capable of doing, no matter how irrational or self-destructive. He worried that SAC bombers and ICBMs might be vulnerable to a surprise Soviet nuclear attack, and supported the deployment of an anti-ballistic missile, ABM, system to defend them. McNamara had dropped plans to build a large-scale ABM system when he learned that defensive weapons cost 5 times as much as the missiles they protected against and could be easily overwhelmed by sending more ICBMs. Scientists throughout the country mobilized in opposition to ABM, which they believed expensive, unnecessary, unworkable, and likely to further propel the arms race. McNamara knew that the U.S. deterrent was more than adequate. When he declared in 1964 that a 400-megaton nuclear force would be enough to destroy the Soviet Union, the U.S. stockpile was already 42.5 times that size, and growing rapidly. Wallstetter and veteran hawk Paul Nitze formed the Committee to Maintain a Prudent Defense Policy and set out to defeat the ABM Treaty. They recruited Richard Pearl, Edward Luttwak, Peter Wilson, and Paul Wolfowitz. One committee enthusiast, Dean Acheson, anointed them our four musketeers. Wilson and Wolfowitz had studied with Wallstetter at the University of Chicago, where he taught political science. Pearl had become a disciple while still in high school. Following the unsuccessful effort to stop the ABM Treaty, Pearl took a job with Democratic Senator Henry Scoop Jackson's powerful Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Operating from what was known as the bunker, Jackson's foreign policy team would eventually include a gaggle of leading neoconservatives. Jackson and his acolytes bristled at the fact that the SALT Treaty allowed the Soviets a temporary advantage in the number of missiles and in missile throw weight. They ignored the fact that the United States had significant advantages in terms of both numbers of nuclear warheads and technology. The United States also had a 3-to-1 advantage in bombers. Jackson charged U.S. negotiators with having caved in to their Soviet counterparts. He attached an amendment to the SALT Treaty, stipulating that no future treaty could permit the United States anything less than numerical parity in any category of weapons. Jackson pressured the White House into firing a quarter of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, ACDA, staff, including a dozen people involved in SALT negotiations. The new, more conservative head of the ACDA, Fred Ickley, recruited Wolfowitz to fill one of the vacancies. In 1974, Jackson's allies passed the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, which denied trade benefits to any communist nation that restricted citizens' rights to emigrate freely. Kissinger was furious, claiming that the amendment had blighted U.S.-Soviet relations ever after, which was just what Jackson, Pearl, and company wanted. In June 1971, the New York Times began publishing the Pentagon Papers, the Defense Department's secret history of the Vietnam War, showing that the government had systematically lied to the public about Vietnam for years. RAND analyst Daniel Ellsberg was one of the few people to have had access to the study in the summer of 1969. The more he read of the history of the French and then U.S. invasions, the more he understood the moral indefensibility of U.S. policy. By September 1969, he had drawn several key conclusions. The war had been an American war almost from the beginning. It was a struggle of Vietnamese against American policy and American financing, proxies, technicians, firepower, and finally, troops and pilots. It was only U.S. money, weapons, and manpower that had kept the political violence at the scale of a war since 1954. And most significantly, he understood that it was no more a civil war after 1955 or 1960 than it had been during the U.S.-supported French attempt at colonial reconquest, a war in which one side was entirely equipped and paid by a foreign power, which dictated the nature of the local regime in its own interest, was not a civil war. To say that we had interfered in what is really a civil war, as most American academic writers and even liberal critics of the war do to this day, simply screened a more painful reality and was as much a myth as the earlier official one of aggression from the North. In terms of the UN Charter and of our own avowed ideals, it was a war of foreign aggression, American aggression. Ellsberg recalled his former Pentagon boss, John McNaughton, telling RAND researchers that If what you say is true, we're fighting on the wrong side. Ellsberg realized that stating it that way had missed the reality since 1954. We were the wrong side. Therefore, in his mind, the war was a crime, an evil, mass murder. And he knew that Nixon was lying about ending it. In fact, through his bombing policy, Nixon was showing the North that there were no limits to what he was willing to do to achieve victory. Inspired by the example of young activists who chose to go to prison to protest the war, and increasingly desperate to end the bloodshed, Ellsberg photocopied the 47-volume McNamara study. He then tried to convince several senators to enter the study into the public record. When that failed, he went to see Neil Sheehan of the New York Times. On Sunday, June 13, 1971, the Times published the first installment of the Pentagon Papers. On June 15th, the Justice Department filed for an injunction in federal district court in New York. The judge issued a temporary restraining order against the Times. Such an action was unprecedented. An injunction had never before been used to stop the presses in the United States. To circumvent the injunction, Ellsberg then gave the documents to the Washington Post, which took up where the Times left off until it too was blocked. But anticipating that, Ellsberg had gotten copies to 17 other newspapers. After the Post was enjoined, excerpts appeared in the Boston Globe, and then the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. In all, 19 newspapers printed sections of the papers. Meanwhile, the FBI conducted a 13-day manhunt to try to find Ellsberg, who had gone into hiding. The Detroit News interviewed Ellsberg's father, a Republican who had twice voted for Nixon. The elder Ellsberg proudly defended his son's actions. Daniel gave up everything to devote himself to ending that foolish slaughter. If he did give them that report, and if the government accuses him of some crime, well, he might be saving some boys they'd have sent there otherwise. On June 28th, Ellsberg surrendered to the authorities. As he walked toward the federal building, a reporter asked, "How do you feel about going to prison?" Ellsberg replied, "Wouldn't you go to jail to help end the war?" On June 29th, Alaska Democratic Senator Mike Gravel tried unsuccessfully to read the papers on the floor of Congress, but he later managed to read them into the record in a hastily called evening subcommittee session. He also distributed a large number of unpublished top-secret documents to reporters. The following day, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Times, releasing the Times and Post to resume publication. Ellsberg, however, was indicted on criminal felony charges and faced 115 years in prison. Nixon actually welcomed the leaks, showing years of lies about Vietnam by Democratic administrations. He salivated at the thought of leaking more documents, exposing Kennedy's involvement in the Diem assassination. Kissinger called it a gold mine. But when he hesitated to undertake the leaking himself, Nixon instructed Charles Colson to do so. Nixon and Kissinger decided to destroy Ellsberg. Kissinger told Nixon, "Daniel Ellsberg is the most dangerous man in America today. He must be stopped at all costs." In late July, Kissinger railed against Ellsberg to Nixon, "That son of a bitch. First of all, I know him well. I am sure he has some more information. I would bet that he has more information that he's saving for the trial. Examples of U.S. war crimes that triggered him into it." In July, Nixon approved establishing a White House Special Investigations Unit. Former FBI agent G. Gordon Liddy and former CIA agent E. Howard Hunt were brought in to help run things. They hung a plumber's sign on their door and set out to plug the leaks. In September, they broke into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in hopes of finding something to use to silence him before he could release documents Nixon thought he had, revealing Nixon's threats to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. Coming up empty with that break-in, they made further plans to silence Ellsberg, unleashing a wave of dirty tricks and criminal activities that would eventually bring multiple indictments and Nixon's ignominious resignation. Hanoi's spring 1972 offensive pulverized the South Vietnamese army. Desperate to avoid defeat before the election, Nixon contemplated measures so extreme that even Kissinger objected. Power plants, the docks, and I still think we ought to take the dikes out now. Will that drown people? Nixon asked. About 200,000 people, Kissinger informed him. No. I'd rather use the nuclear bomb, Nixon asserted. Kissinger hesitated. That, I think, would just be too much. The nuclear bomb, does that bother you? Nixon asked. I just want you to think big, Henry, for Christ's sakes. Nixon bombed North Vietnamese cities for the first time since 1968, as well as sites throughout the South, and mined Haiphong. He wanted Hanoi to be bombed to smithereens, declaring that the bastards have never been bombed like they're going to be bombed this time. Civilian casualties soared. Nixon felt no remorse, telling Kissinger, "The only place where you and I disagree is with regard to the bombing. You're so goddamn concerned about the civilians, and I don't give a damn. I don't care." Kissinger assured Nixon that his restraint was based on political calculations, not humanitarian ones. "I'm concerned about the civilians because I don't want the world to be mobilized against you as a butcher." In October, the stalled Paris talks suddenly revived. Kissinger announced, "Peace is at hand." But after winning re-election, Nixon unleashed a massive 12-day Christmas bombing campaign against Hanoi and Haiphong, the heaviest bombing of the war. The international outcry was deafening. Peace talks resumed. On January 23rd, Nixon announced an agreement that would end the war and bring peace with honor. The Paris Peace Accords were signed on January 27th. The United States ceased military activities, and the last U.S. troops departed on March 29th, 1973. Approximately 150,000 North Vietnamese soldiers remained in the South, though they were to respect the ceasefire. Thieu would retain power pending the results of elections in which all would participate. But in fact, he made no effort to hold such elections. Nixon assuaged Thieu by increasing the already massive military support and promising to restart the bombing if the communists attempted a new offensive. In April, within weeks of the U.S. troops' departure, Nixon and Kissinger ordered a resumption of bombing in both the North and the South, bombing more intense than at any previous point in the war. The order was rescinded, Time magazine reported, when Nixon learned of John Dean's damning revelations to Watergate prosecutors. Nixon decided not to inflame public opinion by bombing at the same time he was preparing to battle Congress, a determination he would make for the rest of his time in office. The war dragged on for two more years. On April 30th, 1975, the North Vietnamese seized Saigon. The war was finally over. By its end, the United States had dropped more bombs on tiny Vietnam than had been dropped by all sides in all previous wars throughout history. 3 times as many explosives as were dropped by all sides in World War II. Unexploded ordnance blanketed the countryside. 19 million gallons of herbicide poisoned the environment. In the South, the United States had destroyed 9,000 of the 15,000 hamlets. In the North, it had rained destruction on all 6 industrial cities, leveling 28 of 30 provincial towns and 96 of 116 district towns. Lê Duan, who took over the leadership of North Vietnam when Ho died in 1969, told a visiting journalist that the United States had threatened to use nuclear weapons on 13 different occasions. The war's human toll was staggering. More than 58,000 Americans had died in the fighting. But that paled in comparison to the number of Vietnamese killed and wounded. Robert McNamara would later tell students at American University that 3.8 million Vietnamese had died. The horrors of Cambodia exceeded those of Vietnam. In December 1972, Nixon instructed Kissinger, "I want everything that can fly to go in there and crack the hell out of them. There is no limitation on mileage, and there is no limitation on budget. Is that clear?" Kissinger conveyed the orders to his assistant, General Alexander Haig. He wants a massive bombing campaign in Cambodia. He doesn't want to hear anything. It's an order. It's to be done. Anything that flies on anything that moves. You got that? The bombing continued until August 15, 1973, when Congress cut funding for the war. More than 100,000 sites were hit, with more than 3 million tons of ordnance. The attacks left hundreds of thousands of civilians dead. The Cambodian economy lay in tatters. Inflation skyrocketed, especially food prices. Production dwindled. Rice production was barely one-sixth of pre-war levels. Starvation was rampant. Not everyone suffered, though. The elite frolicked in opulence and splendor. Refugees flooded into Phnom Penh, creating a humanitarian crisis. Approximately 95% of all income came from the United States. By early 1974, U.S. humanitarian aid totaled $2.5 million, compared with $516.5 million in military aid. The Khmer Rouge, which had been a weak force prior to the bombing, used those atrocities to recruit in the same way that others would later use U.S. atrocities to recruit in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to Khmer Rouge officer Chit Dol, every time there had been bombing, they would take the people to see the craters, to see how big and deep the craters were, to see how the earth had been gouged out and scorched. The ordinary people sometimes literally shit in their pants when the big bombs and shells came. Their minds just froze up, and they would wander around mute for 3 or 4 days. Terrified and half crazy, the people were ready to believe what they were told. It was because of their dissatisfaction with the bombing that they kept on cooperating with the Khmer Rouge, joining up with the Khmer Rouge, sending their children off to go with them. Sometimes the bombs fell and hit little children, and their fathers would be all for the Khmer Rouge. The Khmer Rouge grew exponentially. Terrifying reports circulated of the fanaticism of its young cadre. In 1975, it seized power. It wasted little time in unleashing new horrors against its own people, leading to a genocide in which more than 1.5 million people perished, on top of the 500,000 or so who had been killed in the U.S. phase of the war. The United States, given its new alliance with China, Cambodia's principal ally, maintained friendly relations with the brutal Pol Pot regime. In late 1975, Kissinger told the Thai foreign minister, "You should tell the Cambodians that we will be friends with them. They are murderous thugs, but we won't let that stand in our way." Fortunately, Hanoi did not turn a blind eye. In 1978, it tried to spark the Cambodians to rise up against a government Vietnamese leaders described as the most disgusting murderers in the latter half of this century. Vietnam invaded that year, eventually toppling Pol Pot's heinous regime. The Vietnamese reported, "In Cambodia, a former island of peace, no one smiles today. Now the land is soaked with blood and tears. Cambodia is hell on earth." Perhaps a quarter of Cambodia's population died during the Khmer Rouge's brief rule. If the United States did not wreak similar devastation on Laos, it was not for lack of trying. The United States had been secretly bombing Laos since 1964. It was no secret to the Laotians. Starting in 1967, the pace of the bombing picked up. Civilian suffering increased. When Nixon took over, all restraints were removed. Belgian UN advisor Georges Chapelier detailed the situation on the basis of interviews with survivors. "Prior to 1967, bombing was light and far from populated centers. By 1968, the intensity of the bombings was such that no organized life was possible in the villages. The villages moved to the outskirts and then deeper and deeper into the forest as the bombing climax reached its peak in 1969, when jet planes came daily and destroyed all stationary structures. Nothing was left standing. The villagers lived in trenches and holes or in caves. They only farmed at night. All of the interlocutors, without any exception, had his village completely destroyed. In the last phase, bombings were aimed at the systematic destruction of the material basis of the civilian society. Harvest burned down, and rice became scarce. Between 1965 and 1973, the United States dropped 2,756,941 tons of ordnance in 230,516 sorties on 113,716 sites. The Pathet Lao-controlled Plain of Jars region was one of the areas that took the brunt of the U.S. offensive. Most of the Yang left to join the Pathet Lao. U.S. allied Mio soldiers evacuated the remaining villagers. By September 1969, the area was largely deserted. Fred Bramfman, who interviewed more than 1,000 refugees, wrote, "After a recorded history of 700 years, the Plain of Jars disappeared. Much of Laos suffered a similar fate." Nixon barely had time to savor his 1972 electoral victory before the Watergate scandal engulfed his administration. Congressional investigations revealed the depths of corruption and abuses of power. The floodgates opened when Alexander Butterfield disclosed the White House tapes, without which Nixon would have avoided impeachment. At the time, Butterfield said he hoped he wouldn't be asked about the tapes, and when asked, did not want to perjure himself. He later admitted privately that he hoped committee members would ask that question. He said that while sitting in on Nixon, Ehrlichman, and Haldeman's discussions of who they were going to pin Watergate on, he had concluded that they were despicable, ruthless human beings, and had decided not to protect them. The public soon discovered what John Mitchell referred to as the White House horrors. In October, Vice President Spiro Agnew was forced out of office over bribes and kickbacks he had received when governor of Maryland. Nixon appointed the likable but undistinguished House Minority Leader, Gerald Ford, to replace Agnew. One observer noted, "Few men are better qualified than Ford for a job that demands practically nothing of the man who holds it." The House Judiciary Committee drafted 3 articles of impeachment for obstructing justice, misusing the powers of the presidency, and refusing to comply with the committee's requests for information. Pressure to resign came from all sides. Many observers felt that Nixon was becoming dangerously paranoid. Wary of what Nixon might do, Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger met with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and instructed that no military units respond to orders from the White House without first getting his approval. By early August, Nixon's support in Congress had evaporated. Having run out of time and options, he resigned on August 9th, 1974. Gerald Ford announced, "Our long national nightmare is over," and later gave the madman Nixon a controversial pardon. But 40 government officials and members of Nixon's re-election committee were convicted of felonies. Among those sentenced to prison terms were Dean, Mitchell, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, political assistants Charles Colson, Egil Crow, and Jeb Stuart Magruder, and the president's lawyer, Herbert Kalmbach. Nixon impersonator David Fry quipped, "There's a bright side to Watergate. My administration has taken crime out of the streets and put it in the White House where I can keep an eye on it." Psychopathic Kissinger came through unscathed. In October 1973, he and North Vietnam's Lê Duc Tho were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Tom Lehrer, America's most brilliant political satirist, announced that Kissinger's winning the Nobel Peace Prize made political satire obsolete and refused ever to perform again. Unlike Kissinger, Lê Duc Tho, knowing that peace had not yet been achieved, had the decency to turn the prize down. Historian Carolyn Eisenberg aptly pointed out, "Richard Nixon was the only president in American history to engage in sustained military action against 3 nations without a mandate from the public, the press, the government bureaucracies, or the foreign elite." Chapter 10. Collapse of Détente. Darkness at Noon. Jimmy Carter has been a marvelous ex-president, perhaps, as he has claimed, the best in U.S. history. Although John Quincy Adams, who returned to Congress to wage an impassioned struggle against slavery, could have given him a run for his money, Carter can make a very strong case. In 1982, he founded the Carter Center, through which he has promoted democracy, improved health care in underdeveloped countries, secured the release of prisoners, helped restore Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, to power, and spoken on Cuban TV, urging the United States to end its embargo and imploring Castro to improve civil liberties. In 1994, he negotiated a nuclear deal with Kim Il-sung that significantly slowed the growth of North Korea's nuclear arsenal. In his work monitoring elections around the world, he dismissed the opposition's claims of fraud in sanctioning the 2004 recall election victory of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. He has tried to inject reason into the long-festering Arab-Israeli conflict, issuing highly controversial criticisms of all the antagonists, including the Israelis. He decried George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, called for the shuttering of the prison at Guantanamo Bay, and labeled the Bush-Cheney administration the worst in history. He has called for the abolition of nuclear weapons and remains the only U.S. president ever to have visited the city of Hiroshima. For his courageous stands and global leadership, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002. Yet Carter, who has performed in such exemplary fashion out of office, was inept in office, disappointing his supporters, betraying his convictions, and leaving with an approval rating of 34%. Carter's most enduring legacy as president was not his hypocrisy-stained campaign for human rights. It was his opening the door to the dark side, legitimizing the often brutal policies of his successor, Ronald Reagan, policies that rekindled the Cold War and left a trail of innocent victims stretching from Guatemala to Afghanistan and back again to the World Trade Center. How did that happen? Were the same forces at work during the Carter years that had undermined the administrations of other Democratic presidents, including Wilson, Truman, Johnson, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama? Nixon's resignation in August 1974 and the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Vietnam paved the way for a serious assessment of what had gone wrong and a reversal of the policies that had led the nation astray, both domestically and globally. But that rarely occurred, certainly not during the presidency of the amiable and well-meaning but extremely limited Gerald Ford, a man who, Lyndon Johnson said, could not walk and chew gum at the same time. From the start, Ford sent all the wrong signals. First, he announced that Henry Kissinger would stay on as both Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. Kissinger understood that the United States was facing severe economic and political challenges. After 70 years of trade surpluses, it had run its first deficit in 1971. Now that deficit was widening. The oil-exporting countries in the Middle East, which had joined together to form OPEC, decided to punish the United States, Western Europe, and Japan for supporting Israel in the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. The price of oil quadrupled in the next year. The United States, which in the 1950s had produced all the oil it needed, was now importing more than one-third of its supply, making it very vulnerable to this kind of economic pressure. With wealth and power shifting to the Middle East, several U.S. allies adopted more Arab-friendly policies, which Kissinger denounced as contemptible. Kissinger and other top officials contemplated a different kind of response, even floating the idea of invading Saudi Arabia. Did the United States really want another war? The country was still reeling from its humiliating defeat by Vietnam, which Kissinger had denigrated as a little fourth-rate power. No wonder he was feeling despondent over the future of the American empire. 2 months into the Ford administration, he told the New York Times' James Reston, "As a historian, You have to be conscious of the fact that every civilization that has ever existed has ultimately collapsed. History is a tale of efforts that failed, of aspirations that weren't realized, of wishes that were fulfilled and then turned out to be different from what one expected. So, as a historian, one has to live with a sense of the inevitability of tragedy. North Vietnam began its final offensive in March 1975. The South offered little resistance. Without U.S. forces there to fight its battles and bolster its resolve, the South Vietnamese army simply collapsed. One South Vietnamese officer called it a rout unique in the annals of military history. With the South Vietnamese troops in full flight, chaos engulfed much of the country. Soldiers murdered officers, fellow soldiers, and civilians. Defense Secretary James Schlesinger told Ford that only tactical nuclear weapons could prevent defeat. Ford resisted the temptation to use them. Journalist Jonathan Schell realized that this final collapse revealed the true nature of the war. He wrote of South Vietnam, "It was a society entirely without inner cohesion, held together only by foreign arms, foreign money, foreign political will. When deprived of that support, it faced its foe alone, and the mirage evaporated." Under pressure from the United States, Nguyen Van Thieu resigned on April 21st. On April 30th, General Duong Van Minh surrendered to North Vietnamese Colonel Bui Tin. Minh said, "I have been waiting since early this morning to transfer power to you." But Tin responded, "You cannot give up what you do not have." Images of South Vietnamese soldiers shooting their way onto planes and U.S. Marines beating down desperate Vietnamese trying to escape on the last U.S. helicopters lifting off the embassy roof would remain indelibly imprinted in the American psyche for decades to come. 2 years earlier, at the Paris Peace Conference, Nixon had signed a secret protocol promising between $4.25 and $4.75 billion in post-war aid, without any political conditions. Nixon and Secretary of State William Rogers denied the protocol's existence. "We have not made any commitment for any reconstruction or rehabilitation effort," Rogers insisted. Ford cited the North Vietnamese victory as proof that Hanoi had reneged on the Paris agreements and blocked the promised aid. He also imposed an embargo on all of Indochina, froze Vietnamese assets in the United States, and vetoed Vietnamese membership in the United Nations. The Vietnamese, who had suffered so deeply during the U.S. invasion, would be left to rebuild their war-ravaged land on their own. Nearly 4 million of their citizens had been killed. The landscape had been shattered. The beautiful triple canopy forests were largely gone. In 2009, landmines and unexploded bombs still contaminated over a third of the land in 6 central Vietnamese provinces. Efforts by the Vietnamese government, the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, and the Vietnam Veterans of America, sometimes led by dedicated U.S. veterans like Chuck Searcy in Quang Tri Province, had cleared over 3,000 acres. But over 16 million acres remained to be cleared. Beyond the terrible toll of the war itself, 42,000 more Vietnamese, including many children, were killed by leftover explosives in the years after the war ended. U.S. veterans would suffer too. By some estimates, the number of Vietnam vets who have committed suicide has exceeded the 58,000 plus who died in combat. Instead of helping the American people learn from this execrable episode in U.S. history, Ford encouraged Americans to regain the sense of pride that existed before Vietnam. The fact that the United States had not learned the lesson that it should never again support a corrupt dictatorship determined to silence the cries for justice from an oppressed people would come back to haunt it repeatedly in future years. Reeling from defeat in Vietnam, the United States went out of its way to cultivate anti-communist allies in the region. Ford and Kissinger visited General Suharto, Indonesia's right-wing dictator, in early December. The day they left, Suharto's military invaded the newly independent nation of East Timor, a former Portuguese colony. Suharto had asked his guests for understanding if we deem it necessary to take rapid or drastic action in toppling East Timor's left-wing government. Ford assured him, "We will understand and not press you on the issue." Kissinger urged Suharto to postpone the invasion until he and Ford had returned to the United States and to finish the job quickly. The invasion proved to be bloody and the occupation prolonged. The estimated death toll from the invasion plus starvation and disease ranges from 100,000 to 200,000 and more. 300,000 people, over half the population, were relocated to camps run by the Indonesian military. The United States continued providing military aid to Indonesia until 1999. East Timor did not regain full independence until 2002. Following Nixon's ouster, conservatives set out to purge the intelligence community of CIA analysts who didn't believe the Soviets were out to conquer the world. Led by Air Force Intelligence Chief Major General George Keegan, they convinced CIA Director George H.W. Bush to give a group of anti-Soviet hardliners, labeled Team B, unprecedented access to the country's most sensitive intelligence so that they could challenge the CIA's findings about the Soviet Union. In the eyes of CIA analysts, Keegan had already discredited himself with fanciful reports of a Soviet-directed energy weapons program that would give the Soviet Union an enormous advantage over the United States. Rebuffed by military and intelligence experts, he went public with his outlandish theories when he retired. He convinced the editors of Aviation Week and Space Technology to write in May 1977, "The Soviet Union has achieved a technical breakthrough in high-energy physics applications that may soon provide it with a directed energy beam weapon capable of neutralizing the entire United States ballistic missile force and checkmating this country's strategic doctrine. The race to perfect directed energy weapons is a reality." Despite the fact that no such Soviet project existed, the United States began its own space-based laser weapons program in 1978 under the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. This eventually led to the much-ballyhooed and incredibly wasteful Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. Keegan also incorrectly insisted that the Soviets were building a large-scale civil defense system designed to safeguard much of the Soviet population in the event of a nuclear war. Howard Storz, who oversaw the production of national intelligence estimates on the Soviet Union, explained why he and others at the CIA objected to this type of outside scrutiny. "Most of us were opposed to it because we saw it as an ideological, political foray, not an intellectual exercise. We knew the people who were pleading for it." Harvard Russia historian Richard Pipes, a virulently anti-Soviet Polish immigrant, was put in charge of Team B. Pipes quickly recruited Paul Nitze and Paul Wolfowitz. According to Ann Kahn, who worked at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency under President Carter, Team B members shared an apoplectic animosity toward the Soviet Union. They greatly overestimated the USSR's military spending and capabilities, predicting that the Soviets would have around 500 backfire bombers by early 1984, more than double the actual number. They put the most malign interpretation on the Soviets' intentions, accusing them of using détente as a ruse to gain hegemony. They rejected the CIA assessment that Soviet nuclear capabilities were primarily defensive in nature, designed to deter and retaliate, not attack. Pipes complained that the CIA assessments happened to favor détente and to place the main burden for its success on the United States. He attributed this to the fact that the CIA's analytic staff shared the outlook of U.S. academe, with its penchant for philosophical positivism, cultural agnosticism, and political liberalism. Actual Soviet behavior, Pipes argued, indicated beyond reasonable doubt that the Soviet leadership regarded nuclear weapons as tools of war whose proper employment promised victory. Pipes's report found the Soviets far ahead in every strategic category. The CIA dismissed it as complete fiction. Kahn concluded, If you go through most of Team B's specific allegations about weapon systems, they were all wrong. On November 5th, Team B members debated the CIA Soviet analysts, most of whom were younger and less experienced. One of the CIA participants recalled, "We were overmatched. People like Nitze ate us for lunch." A CIA official reported, "It was like putting Walt Whitman high versus the Redskins." The agency had blundered, Pipes gloated, by pitting a troop of young analysts, some of them barely out of graduate school, against senior government officials, general officers, and university professors. Pipes reported that when Team A's champion, the young analyst Ted Cherry, began his criticism of Team B's findings, Nitze fired a question that reduced him to a state of catatonic immobility. We stared in embarrassment as he sat for what seemed an interminable time, with an open mouth, unable to utter a sound. Though Bush and his successor, Stansfield Turner, both joined Kissinger in dismissing Team B's findings, Bush made sure that this harsher assessment of Soviet capabilities and intentions was incorporated into intelligence reports. This ill-fated intervention in CIA affairs turned more ominous in September 1978, when a former high-level CIA official, John Paisley, went missing after sailing in the Chesapeake Bay. Paisley, who had been Deputy Director of Strategic Research, was an expert on Soviet nuclear and other weapons programs, with authority to request launching of spy satellites. He had been the CIA liaison with Team B. His son claimed that he had been responsible for leaking the story of Team B's existence to the press. A week later, a badly decomposed body was pulled from the bay and identified as Paisley's by Maryland police. It had a gunshot wound in the head. The police quickly concluded that it was a case of suicide. But if so, it was a bizarre suicide indeed. The body found had two 19-pound diver's belts strapped across its midsection. It was 4 inches shorter than the 5-foot-11-inch Paisley. And according to writer Nicholas Thompson, if the body was his, and if he had done himself in, he had chosen an awkward method. Paisley was right-handed, but he would have had to have attached the weights, leaned over the side, and shot himself execution style through the left temple. In addition to the investigation by the Maryland State Police, investigations were conducted by the CIA, the FBI, and the Senate Intelligence Committee. Meanwhile, the CIA put out various cover stories, which were quickly discredited. The CIA described Paisley, who had supposedly left the agency in 1974, as a part-time consultant with a very limited access to classified information, a description that a former high-level staffer on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, PFIAB, found shocking. There is no question that Paisley, at the time of his death, had access to highly classified intelligence information, he informed the Baltimore Sun, which conducted its own 3-month investigation. One former PFIAB White House staffer revealed, "It was Paisley who developed the list of people who would serve on the B-team. It was his job to get these guys clearances, to discuss their backgrounds with us. Then, after the team had been selected, he would schedule the briefings. He shaped the entire process." The Sun reported that at the time of his death, Paisley was writing a retrospective analysis of Team B for an in-house agency publication. Among the papers found on the boat were Paisley's notes on the history of the project. Other highly classified documents relating to Soviet defense spending and the state of Soviet military readiness were also in his possession. Speculation abounded that something more nefarious had occurred. Some CIA insiders told reporters that they believed the KGB had murdered Paisley. Others contended that he was a KGB mole who had been whacked by the CIA. Paisley's wife charged that the body didn't belong to her estranged husband and hired an attorney and investigator. "My feeling is that something very sinister is happening," she said, accusing the CIA of telling lies about her husband. Two prominent insurance companies initially refused to pay benefits to Mrs. Paisley because of doubts that her husband was actually dead. After a lengthy investigation, The Senate Intelligence Committee decided to keep its report secret. The mystery has never been solved. Meanwhile, the hardline anti-détente forces were roiling the waters on a number of fronts. In March 1976, NHTSA, James Schlesinger, and former Undersecretary of State Eugene Rostow had set in motion what in November would become the Committee on the Present Danger, CPD. A committee by that name had been established once before, in 1950, to back NHTSA's NSC 68. Three Team B members, NHTSA, Pipes, and William Van Cleve, served on the executive committee. Among the early supporters were Mellon heir Richard Mellon Scaife and the future director of Central Intelligence, William Casey. Members included Commentary magazine editor Norman Podoretz, Richard Perle, Dean Rusk, and Ronald Reagan. The CPD's founding statement warned that the Soviet Union sought dominance through an unparalleled military buildup, and that under the cover of arms control, it was preparing to fight and win a nuclear war. The Team B and CPD efforts to subvert the intelligence community and drive the country to the right were cheered on by a network of newly formed foundations and think tanks, funded in part by the Scaife family, the Coors family, and William Simon, president of the John M. Olin Foundation. Among the recipients of such largesse were the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hudson Institute, the Manhattan Institute, the Federalist Society, the Washington Legal Foundation, the Institute for Justice, the Hoover Institute, Freedom House, and the Ethics and Public Policy Center. These interests backed a series of right-wing publications, including National Interest, Public Interest, Commentary, and The American Spectator. This burgeoning right-wing network had little use for a relative moderate like Gerald Ford. Its members itched to put a real right-winger like Reagan into the White House. Ford and his White House Chief of Staff, Donald Rumsfeld, attempted to mollify Ford's critics. They engineered a major cabinet shakeup in October 1975, known as the Halloween Day Massacre. Rumsfeld took over for Schlesinger at Defense. General Brent Scowcroft replaced Kissinger as National Security Advisor. Bush replaced William Colby at the CIA. Dick Cheney, Rumsfeld's deputy, took over as White House Chief of Staff. And Vice President Nelson Rockefeller was informed that he was off the ticket in 1976. Kissinger, furious, drafted a letter of resignation that he never sent. Many saw Rumsfeld's fingerprints all over this shakeup. Nixon had described Rumsfeld as a ruthless little bastard. Kissinger later said Rumsfeld was the most ruthless man he'd ever met. Spurning his once moderate views, Rumsfeld had moved steadily to the right, positioning himself as a staunch defender of Team B and foe of Kissinger's détente policies. He helped block a new SALT treaty in early 1976. The opposition came from Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I recognized that they held the trump card, Ford later wrote. Rumsfeld began warning that the Soviets threatened to overtake the United States in military strength, and that détente was not in the United States' interests. Ford got the message, announcing in March 1976, "We are going to forget the use of the word détente." That capitulation was not enough to placate the party's resurgent right wing. Ronald Reagan excoriated the moderate policies advocated by Nixon, Ford, and Kissinger, which he believed were weakening the United States in the fight against its mortal communist foes. In late March, he accused Kissinger of saying, "The day of the U.S. is past, and today is the day of the Soviet Union. My job as Secretary of State is to negotiate the most acceptable second-best position available." Kissinger, not surprisingly, denied having ever made such remarks. Ford managed to stave off the attack from the neocon-infused Republican right, but was narrowly defeated in November by former Governor Jimmy Carter, a millionaire peanut farmer and longtime Sunday school teacher from Plains, Georgia. Carter, an evangelical Baptist, ran as a populist and an outsider, appealing to blacks, farmers, and disaffected youth. More of a New South agribusinessman than a small farmer, Carter, as historian Leah Rebuffo pointed out, harked back to the pre-World War I progressives, who stressed scientific efficiency and public morality, more than to the New Deal and Great Society reformers, who wanted to strengthen the welfare state. Carter promised to restore trust in government and heal the wounds resulting from divisions over Watergate, the Vietnam War, and years of generational, gender, and racial discord. The little Carter knew about foreign policy came from meetings of the Trilateral Commission, an organization founded in 1972 by Chase Manhattan Bank chairman David Rockefeller, who also headed the influential Council on Foreign Relations, CFR. Rockefeller and many of his establishment cronies were troubled by recent developments. Not only was the United States suffering a monumental defeat in Vietnam, it was facing a destabilizing economic crisis. Many found Nixon's response threatening. By abandoning the gold standard and imposing wage and price controls and a tariff on imports, Nixon was undermining the liberal internationalism that had reigned supreme since 1945. When Nixon's measures were viewed alongside labor's and Congress's efforts to limit imports and punish multilateral corporations that ship jobs overseas, some members of the CFR feared the resurgence of economic nationalism and even the outbreak of an international trade war. Looking for a new instrument to help stabilize the international order, the CFR had been rendered largely ineffectual by a sharp split over Vietnam. Rockefeller seized upon the approach suggested by Columbia University professor Zbigniew Brzezinski. In his 1970 book, Between Two Ages, Brzezinski called for a community of developed nations from Western Europe, the United States, and Japan to guide the international order. The two New Yorkers, who vacationed near each other in Seal Harbor, mapped out the kind of organization that could bring this to fruition. At the June 1972 annual meeting of the secretive Bilderberg Group, held at the Hotel de Bilderberg in Oosterbeek, the Netherlands, Rockefeller proposed forming an organization that would bolster the world capitalist order by strengthening ties among leaders on the three continents. Brzezinski, who was a member of both the Bilderberg Group and the CFR, enthusiastically seconded the proposal. 17 members attended a planning meeting at Rockefeller's New York estate the following month. Beginning with 60 members on each continent, they set up offices in New York, Paris, and Tokyo. Most rejected the CPD's knee-jerk anti-communism, hoping instead to lure the Soviets into an international system that promoted economic interdependence and free flow of trade and capital. Third world economic and political problems would be addressed outside the Cold War framework. Brzezinski served as executive director of the Commission's North American branch. The son of a Polish diplomat, and probably the most unreconstructed anti-communist among the founding members, he tapped Carter for membership. He and Rockefeller saw in Carter a rising, though still little-known, Southern governor who was eager to be educated about the world. Always confident and ambitious, Carter was already discussing a run for the presidency with his close advisors. He had yet to make a splash on the national scene. When he appeared on the television show What's My Line in December 1973, none of the panelists, Arlene Francis, Gene Shalit, Soupy Sales, could identify what he did for a living. Perhaps Brzezinski was impressed that Carter had nominated hardline anti-communist and neocon favorite Senator Henry Scoop Jackson for president at the 1972 Democratic National Convention. Brzezinski and Rockefeller saw something in Carter that convinced them that he was worth cultivating and got behind his candidacy early. Carter's deputy campaign manager, Peter Bourne, revealed that David and Zbig had both agreed that Carter was the ideal politician to build on. Brzezinski served as Carter's foreign policy advisor and speechwriter during the campaign. Carter filled out his administration with 26 fellow trilateralists, including Vice President Walter Mondale, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, Secretary of Defense Harold Brown, Treasury Secretary Michael Blumenthal, and Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker. At the CIA, Carter replaced Trilateral Commission member Bush with fellow member Stansfield Turner. Trilateralists, including Warren Christopher, Anthony Lake, and Richard Holbrooke, also populated the secondary ranks. Most significantly, Carter selected Brzezinski as his national security advisor. Trilateralist Kissinger was not offered a position in the administration. Despite his inexperience, trilateralist connections, and centrist instincts, Carter came into office with a moderately progressive vision of what the United States could become. Among his top priorities was cutting defense spending. During the campaign, he had denounced U.S. nuclear hypocrisy. "By enjoining sovereign nations to forego nuclear weapons, we are asking for a form of self-denial that we have not been able to accept ourselves." Rejecting the typical double standard that powerful nations imposed on weaker ones, he recognized that the United States didn't have the right to ask others to deny themselves such weapons, unless it was actively moving to eliminate its own nuclear arsenal. "The world is waiting, but not necessarily for long," he realized. "The longer effective arms reduction is postponed, the more likely it is that other nations will be encouraged to develop their own nuclear capability."